brings that idea of bring the war home. I mean, they're really showing what it's like for Iraqis to live in this occupied city, and also for the psychological.
This is Radio Freedom, the voice of the African National Congress, South Africa's time-tested revolutionary movement.
Their peaceful protest against the sighting of cruise missiles here is into its second winter, despite attempts to evict the women.
They've really communicated using the internet. That's another part that's important to thinking about social movement culture, is using the tools available.
You have these moments when factory workers become artists, and artists are the ones who are occupying the factory while the workers are making posters, and the world turns upside down, and it's in those moments where the potential for change really opens up.
Tonight on Circle A Radio, we'll take you on an audio tour through the art exhibition Signs of Change, Social Movement Cultures, 1960s to Now. Hundreds of posters, photographs, video, and audio representing more than 40 years of activism, political protest, and social justice campaigns are on display until March 19th at the Pacific Northwest College of Arts, Feldman Gallery, and Project Space.
This is Alec Dunn, our tour guide.
We're at the Signs of Change art show at the Pacific Northwest College of Art. It was an art show curated by Josh McPhee and Derek Greenwald, who are artists, activists, and curators from New York City. And my name is Alec Dunn, and I am a co-editor with Josh McPhee of a separate project called Signal, which is a book series concerned with international political art, culture, and graphics.
We'll also bring you a sampling of archival audio from a handful of social justice movements represented at Signs of Change. Stay tuned.
First up, we'll hear Josh McPhee address the role of the artist in social movements.
They're rare as well, but there have been shows that sort of mount a history of the role of the artist in movements. And we sort of turned away from that because we actually thought for us it was less interesting. Joseph Beuys played a huge role in the anti-nuclear movement, particularly in Germany. And you know, there's a poster up there that he participated in. It was for an action that he was part of. But that is less interesting to us than the larger context. What's really interesting about the role of art is that often this stuff is produced by people that never thought that they were going to be artists, or produced by 10 people at once in a way that within modernist conceptions of art seems practically impossible. This just bursts open the idea of what an artist is. You have these moments when factory workers become artists, and artists are the ones who are occupying the factory while the workers are making posters, and the world turns upside down, and it's in those moments where the potential for change really opens up. And it's not just about change of one government with another, but what our practice in daily life looks like, what we potentially can do, how we see ourselves. This is an immense amount of evidence that when given the opportunity, there's lots of people that see themselves as producers of culture.
Again, Alec Dunn.
The Signs of Change show, if you come down to the show, you should enter in the little room on the left, and it starts with the section called Struggle for the Land.
We decided to put this section together and to start the show with it because a couple of reasons. One, living in North America, all the land that we're standing on originally was occupied by other peoples, and the injustice that was done to them is kind of this baseline issue that's never really been dealt with in our society. And then all of the other struggles that we're talking about are kind of built on top of that. And we thought it was important to acknowledge this as literally underneath where we're standing. And sort of the root of a lot of what the rest of the show ultimately is about.
When we did this show, originally it was meant to be on the 40th anniversary of 68, which was 2008, and also it also opened during the presidential election season, and we wanted, there's no electoral politics in this show. That was an intentional decision we made because we knew there was going to be election fever around when this show opened in September 08. But also the 60th anniversary of 68, there was a lot of different cultural exhibitions happening all over the place, and looking back at 68, and a lot of them included Black Panthers and certain feminist contexts, but we had not seen any that included the American Indian movement.
Beginning with that section, they start with some photos and documents from the seizure of Alcatraz in the Bay Area. And I think it's a really appropriate place to start the show because it was an action that I think was really well thought out on a lot of levels. I mean, it was it's right across from a major American city. They were claiming it as historical Indian land. It was an abandoned prison at the time. It was a real powerful, powerful symbol of what the American Indian movement wanted to do, what they could do, what they are capable of.
This is John Trudell welcoming you to Indian Land Radio, Indian Land Alcatraz Island, on behalf of the Indians of all tribes. Our resident population stands at 150, 105 adults, 45 children. There are 24 in grades 1 through 7 and 19 preschoolers. Our first invasion was November the 14th, 1969. There were 13 people in on this invasion, all college students from the Bay Area. And then the second invasion took place November the 20th, 1969, with 89 men, women, and children.
Many of the people now understand that Alcatraz belongs, is not only here on the island, but it's a part of every reservation, it's a part of every person.
And Alcatraz led from there, it led up to Washington, to the movement in Washington for the fishing rights. And then later, it led to Washington, D.C., then later led to Custer, Rapid City, South Dakota, Wounded Knee, and various occupations after.
Red Arrow, RV-4, try and use that 79, try and flush them onto that bunker, and you'll have good targets.
The ultimatum was given to them again to negotiate or massacre. They cut off the negotiations and were left with only one alternative, and that was to come in and massacre. They have chosen not to massacre at this point. Again, we will make the first move to defuse the situation. We were fired upon by FBI agents. We did not return any fire, and we will not return any fire again tonight. However, if any of our people are killed because of our dedication to defuse this issue, we can guarantee no safety for any FBI agent that fires upon us. In the meantime, we remain at Wounded Knee.
Where's the two guys?
Where?
We feel that this position is so solidified amongst the Indian people here that there's no way that we'll ever change our stance here. We also feel that the federal government will never be able to grasp the fact that it is legally our right to have an independent nation within the boundaries of the USA, and that they will possibly tonight start an armed invasion of our nation. They have the armed force strength, they have the might to overwhelm our tiny nation. All the American Indian Movement people here and the Oglala Sioux people that are here defending this nation have decided that we'll never leave and that we'll fight here to the last man. And we feel that it's incumbent upon all the people of this country to rally themselves to the issue of freedom of a people and try to stop their own government from committing another reoccurrence of the 1890 massacre of Indian people.
Just giving you great power, nourishing that all may live. Her light is upon us, making the earth bright. The great Mother Earth and all upon it turns into view. We have all arrived together. Behold us arriving with our ancestors, arriving in the vision in the great flood and love. Together, the earth is in our hands. The earth is in our hands. Let the bird of earth fly, and all that lives will rejoice. The people of the earth rising in vast meadows, thunder and lightning on our skin, roaring flesh singing, choruses of millions singing.
It was a move here in the White Clay District in Oglala to establish local control through returning to traditional structures of government. And that involved a lot of getting people together, talking with people about the importance of supporting each other. There were a lot of plans for all kinds of ways of returning to local control, that is, establishing economic bases and all that sort of thing. And Anna May was just very involved within the community, making those plans, helping get people together, and encouraging people to try.
It's fairly largely forgotten now that Alcatraz is a museum, and most people think about it as where Al Capone was imprisoned, so that's a great place to start the show. And then following that, to the right, we do have more images of the American Indian movement. Some beautiful stuff, some paintings, some woodcuts. Interesting one here is there's one that says Centennial Means 500 Years of Genocide, Free Russell Redner and Kenneth Loudhawk. And it's an RCAF flyer, which was the Royal Chicano Air Force art group out of San Francisco. I think it started out as the Rebel Chicano Art Front, and they changed it to the Royal Chicano Air Force at one point. And the only reason I bring this one up, beside that it's an awesome flyer, but there's a local area code, so the contact number is 503 blah 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 blah. I don't know what the local connection with that was, especially because it was a fairly well-known group from California. So local history nerds, come down, clue us in. If we go around the room in the struggle for the land, we see a couple modern things about the resistance to the Olympics that are happening right now in Vancouver. Very timely. To the right of that also we see some stuff from the PLO, from Palestinian struggles, and from the IRA. And they're kind of nicely connected because there was that brief period where you're getting these PLO and IRA mutual solidarity works, and especially in these great murals that are in Northern Ireland.
In the middle of 1970, when following a sectarian attack on one of the nationalist ghetto areas in Belfast, the Short Strand area, the Provisionals were in a position to successfully defend that particular ghetto, where the nationalist people were outnumbered something like 10 to 1. The following week, which was July 1970, in a direct response to the ability of the Republican Army to defend the nationalist ghetto areas, the British Army occupied one major nationalist ghetto area, the Lower Falls. But from the Provisionalist point of view, this was further vindication of why armed struggle was necessary, because this was the first physical manifestation of British imperialism since the 1920s. And for the first time, the people could relate to the Provisionals' claims that sectarianism was in fact just a symptom, and that the main enemy was British imperialism itself. And here was something with which they could identify.
You are listening to Circle A Radio as we take an audio tour through the Signs of Change art exhibit up at PNCA until March 19th. Again, this is Alec Dunn.
There's kind of a funny one at the end, and maybe it's only funny for graphics nerds, but it's the Intifada welcomes the Ica Grata. And the Ica Grata was the International Council of Graphic Design Associations, which was having its 13th Annual Congress in Tel Aviv, Israel, in 1989. And it's a very graphic poster. It's very bold, and it fits in with it being a protest aimed at the Council of Graphic Design. It's a smartly done poster.
This is Josh McPhee and Derek Greenwald.
This section is called Forward to People's Power. A lot of the material in here is maybe some of what's most familiar to people in the U.S. Look at Black Panthers, the civil rights movement in the U.S., feminist movement. And a lot of this material is falls under what people often consider or think of as sort of identity-based struggles. So people not organizing from their position as laborers in relationship to capitalism, but their position as different gender, sexuality, racial category, ethnicity.
In doing this, I found a lot of videos that had not been ever, hadn't been shown since the time they were made, basically, from the Women's Liberation Movement. There's a documentation of a protest organized by Lesbian Feminist Liberation where they built this like really tall purple dinosaur out of paper mache, and they wheeled it down Broadway to the Museum of Natural History to demand that they change the language in the museum to not just be men of the mountain, men of the, and to represent other kinds of sexuality. And here's the poster that advertised that demo. You can see all of their demands, and some of those demands obviously have been won in museums.
In the room for the People's Power, there's a lot of great images from different movements and struggles. There's one that is pretty large, and it's from 1982, it says. And it has text in Farsi, Arabic, and Hebrew. And it shows a woman as kind of a baby machine, producing mothers to produce more babies and to produce boys to become soldiers. And it's interesting internationalist perspective that you don't see represented a lot from the Middle East. It's in the three languages. It's in Hebrew, and it's in Farsi, and it's in Arabic. Looking at a lot of those countries have forced conscription, and it's just a weird, surreal poster. It's pretty great. It's a great one to check out. We also have a few representative works down here from the Young Lords and the Panthers. I, of course, think everyone should know about Emery Douglas, who was chief of culture and arts. He had a fancy title in the Black Panthers, but he was one of the best well-known artists in the Black Panther Party. He illustrated for the Black Panther newspaper and did a lot of the really iconic Black Panther images. And he has just an amazing style. He was really young when he developed it. It incorporated some weird pop art, really graphic kind of optic elements with like a really just awesome, strong, expressive drawing style. And he had this color range that was pretty great of just like pink and purple and black and brown and red, yellow. And his work is just up there. I mean, there's some books out now, and he's been getting some bigger shows, so people are remembering him. And he's still making great art, making great political art. He made a recent flyer for the San Francisco 8. Emery is still out there kicking ass, so it's good to see some of his stuff in the show.
This is Emery Douglas.
I met Huey and Bobby initially in 1967. Around end of January, first part of February, when there was a planning meeting to bring Malcolm X's widow to the Bay Area. And I was asked by the organization at that time to do the artwork for that event. And so I went to the meeting, and they said they were going to bring some, talk to some brothers, come over to do security. And when they came over, that was Huey Newton and Bobby Seale. So it was after that meeting that I asked how could I become a member, and Huey and Bobby gave me their phone numbers, and I used to call Huey in the morning, and I used to catch the bus from here to Oakland and go by Huey's house, and he would show me around the neighborhoods. We'd go by Bobby's house, and that was my initial involvement with the Black Panther Party. All across the country, it was this desire by a lot of young folks who were frustrated in the African-American community, in the inner cities, in the South, everywhere, in relationship to the abuse, the bigotry, and particularly the police abuse of murders and being justified all over the country in relationship to young African-American men being killed and shot and murdered, shot in the back, maybe running from the scene, petty crime, or getting into conflicts with the police and being abused. And people seeing it in the neighborhood, how it was being handled and not handled in a professional way. So it was high levels of frustrations. And so, you know, there were those who respected Dr. King and the nonviolence, but there were also those who didn't want to turn the other cheek and wanted to do, carry it on to in another way. Initially, I was worked on a newspaper that was I did throughout my entire being in the party. I worked on a newspaper, But initially, I was cut and paste when the paper started developing, laying out the paper. Then I became in charge of the newspaper about the second, third, fourth issue of it. And I would start doing artwork and stuff for the paper. But it was the design elements that went into it and stuff that I learned at City College that helped me in relationship to putting the paper together and stuff like that. People could see in the artwork what they maybe perhaps didn't grasp in the language or the communication or through dialogue or something like that, or through an essay, which a lot of folks didn't like to read. The African-American community in the inner cities wasn't really a reading community, but they learned through observation and participation more so. And so Huey and Newman should talk about that. So they wanted to do photographs and images that could tell a story immediately so people could get the gist of what was being meant or discussed or trying to get across, as opposed to reading the whole long article or a paper or something like that. There were some styles that I had that evolved and developed what I did when I was in City College, but they weren't considered commercial styles, so I had to apply my work in a commercial way in order to have a portfolio, so when you went to look for a job or so to a potential employer during that time, you would have a portfolio that was representative of what was going on commercially in the field. But I got involved with the activism and got involved with the Black Panther Party, so when I got into the party, those were the styles that I came back to were the ones that weren't commercial. And they were kind of played off of woodcuts. I kind of like woodcuts. But at the same time, they took so long to do. So I would just try to develop a woodcut style using pen and ink, markers, brush and ink, you know, those the kind of materials that I had available to work with. And out of that evolved and developed the whole visual style that you see of my work. It has to be able to expose the issues of concern to human beings, people who are being oppressed, who are being locked out of the system, and it has to be able to communicate with people. It has to be able to be a reflection of their desires and their interests and concerns if you want to be relevant in relationship to change.
That was Emery Douglas, and again, local artist Alec Dunn.
There's also a cool collection of images around Assata Shakur, which I think is it's interesting if you spend a little more time looking at them, because a lot of them take the same one shot that was used of her, but the devil's in the details on these. So one is Assata Shakur's Welcome Here, which I think was taken off from the same idea. There was one earlier that said, Angela Davis, you're welcome here. That's from the Republic of New Africa, which was a group that's still going on in the South that wanted to form a black state in the southern United States. Below that, there is a free Assata Shakur poster from the Dunnett Community Press in New York City, whose little byline is Survival by Sharing. But there's a lot of these small movement print shops around the country. And if you look around a lot of these posters, you'll see their little symbols on a lot of this stuff. I think there's a real interesting history, a forgotten history, that there were all these little print shops that produced booklets and posters and stuff for the movement, for the political movements going on at the time. And so that's the second one of the Assata Shakur ones. The third one we have from the Madame Ben Graphics Collective. It's a pretty great poster, Support Black Liberation, Free Assata Shakur. I don't know what year it's from. And there is another New African poster at the end. And the final one is, of course, the fairly modern, I saw this at the post office a few years ago, wanted by the FBI wanted poster for Assata Shakur, which is rounding view of Assata Shakur posters that are out in the world.
Walking through the exhibition of hundreds of posters representing social movements from all over the world from the 1960s until now, you may wonder how all those posters were gathered. Next, Dara Greenwald, co-curator of Signs of Change, talks about archives for social movement art.
There's some institutions that are larger, institutions that are more visible. There's the Center for the Study of Political Graphics in Los Angeles, the Museum of Modern Art has some collection. And then there are these smaller movement archives. There's a Lesbian Her Street archive in Brooklyn. They're just community funded and run. And then there's just people, you know, a punk kid who went to Oaxaca and he brought back a bunch of stuff and it's underneath his bed. And or an older person who was involved in things and they have like these rolled up things in their basement. They're like, oh yeah, just take these. So it was kind of like emailing around, talking about a lot. So the archives are accidental and just person's personal collection. And then there's large institutions. One of the interesting things we found in the archives is that some of the larger ones that actually have funding are not that sympathetic to this kind of work. So in one very large art institution I won't name, none of this stuff was cataloged that we got from them, so we couldn't find it in their digital database. So we had to go, you know, get
permission.
We kind
of fight our way into the flat files.
Yeah, get into their flat files. And we get in there, we pull it out, there's a little yellow sticky note that says, not cool enough to catalog. And then another drawer, will catalog whenever. Just the attitude to the material inside the kind of larger archives is that way. Or, for example, the Hoover Institute, which is a right-wing think tank, they have one of the largest collections of political posters in the world because they use it for researching against left movements. It's counterintelligence. It's really interesting. And then some, you know, individuals, like the Center for the Study of Political Graphics is an independent place. They don't have that institutional support, so they don't have enough staff to, like, catalog everything.
Yeah, they have about 70,000 political posters, and they probably catalog 15% of it. The vast majority of what they have sits in flat files because they don't have the time or the resources or the people to actually figure out what it is and get it out into the world to be seen again.
You are listening to Circle A Radio here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland. Tonight, we are on an audio tour of the Signs of Change art exhibit up at the Pacific Northwest College of Art until March 19th. We are speaking with Dara Greenwald and Josh McPhee, the co-curators of the Signs of Change exhibit, and local artist Alec Dunn. In this radio program, we include some audio that can be found at the Signs of Change exhibit and some audio that is from other sources.
The Signs of Change art show is a collection of images and graphics from the last 40 years of social movements, left-wing movements, liberatory movements around the world. One thing they really tried to do with this show that you won't see in a lot of shows that are concerned with political artwork is that I think that they tried to get artists that were actively involved in social movements as opposed to, you know, even there's a show at the Portland Art Museum coming up that I think is all about political art, but it's really people with art careers and big names and, you know, even people in the 70s like Leon Golub or people that were known for doing political art that were artists with large art careers. And a lot of the stuff in the Signs of Change show, a lot of it's anonymous. A lot of it is made by collectives. Some of it is anonymous on purpose. A lot of it was not anonymous just because people were just producing graphics as part of struggles that they were actively involved with. And so there was no thought even to throw your name on it to boost your career or anything like that. It was just what you did as part of your daily life. I think a really great example of this is the Medu Arts Ensemble. And so in the Signs of Change show, there's a wall that is dedicated to images from South Africa. There's some T-shirts, and I don't know the amount of these, but a good amount of these were made by the Medu Art Ensemble. And the Medu Art Ensemble was a collective of black South African artists that was founded in 1978. It was a cultural movement and consisted of musicians and artists and graphic designers and poets and writers and theater people. And it was really tied up in a lot of the struggles in the townships in South Africa and anti-apartheid struggles. But it was also a cultural movement that was, I think, impressive because it was really asserting the richness of black South African culture. What they would do, especially the graphics wing, I mean, there are different wings. They did a lot of like street theater and community theater kind of events. They had jazz listening societies, and I think there was a jazz group associated with Medu, and they would do arts festivals. And the graphics and art wing people would go into townships and do these silk screening workshops. They would teach people, you know, some really simple ways to do silk screening and printing to get posters made about issues that were affecting that particular township or the people that came. So from it, you see a lot of images associated with delivery. There's like either motorcycle or bicycle delivery image that I think was connected with some Metta produced images. You'll see stuff from the Huhudi Youth Organization, which is a poster that's down here, and it's extremely raw by a lot of standards of silk screening, but it's a really powerful poster. It's really beautifully done, and it's a silk screen where I believe they just painted some kind of form to block out the areas as opposed to a lot of the more photo or sophisticated stuff, but it's a great poster with really strong imagery. So a lot of the major stuff in the show is like that. It's really specific to issues that were happening in certain townships. These artists were going in and teaching people how to make their own posters and empowering themselves as well as the groups around them to become cultural producers and to give a kind of visual component to their struggle. And the Metu Art Ensemble was exiled from South Africa. I think they were placed on hit lists by the South African Special Forces and ended up having a headquarters in Zimbabwe. And it dissolved in 1985 when the South African Special Forces actually went in and assassinated a good, I don't know, maybe a majority of the group. But there are still people from Metu around, and there was just a show of their stuff this year in Cape Town or Johannesburg. That's the Metu Art Ensemble.
Throughout the 1970s and 80s, the African National Congress was banned in South Africa, which forced them to communicate to the population and each other through clandestine means, including a series of pirate radio stations. This is Radio Freedom from the 1980s.
This is Radio Freedom, the voice of the African National Congress, South Africa's time-tested revolutionary movement, born of the people into the front line, to spearhead the people's struggle for the seizure of power from the oppressors, a product of the battles of the African continent for liberation.
This evening, the program shall be presented to you in English, Zulu and Sotho by comrades Mahlomola Tau, Edward Dube and Richmond Ramotse. Now stand by.
Our task is to make government impossible for the apartheid regime. Making government impossible means in practical terms that we must destroy those institutions that facilitate government for the Pretoria criminals. Among these institutions, we count the community councils, the bantustans, the tri-racial parliamentary fraud, the pass offices, the rent offices, the courts, the police and army. Any of these institutions is a target of our revolutionary onslaught. Because it is through these institutions that Botha and Malan are able to control our lives. There is only one fate that is facing the apartheid regime. There is only one way that the evil system of apartheid can take, and that is the road to destruction. Already, Pretoria is approaching the precipice. It is on the edge of the bottomless abyss of shame and disgrace in which all oppressive and colonial regimes have fallen. Today, they are fighting with their backs to the wall. We have shown them through the heroic struggles of the past months that we are determined to rid ourselves of the scourge of apartheid once and for all. The length of time that the fascist regime continues to spend in our country, how long it continues to oppress, exploit, and murder us, depends on us. We have a number of advantages over the enemy. We have the superiority of numbers. His economy rests on our shoulders. We work in their kitchens. Let them feel us, for indeed, the truth, the profound truth, is that each and every one of us is a freedom fighter. Each and every one is a guerrilla. The struggle continues, victory is certain. Amandla ngawethu, matla kyaruna, all power to the people.
Comrades, we call upon the youth in their various formations to render unworkable the racist scheme to divide our people into tribal and racial groupings. Forward to a people's government and down with racist elections. Amanda, Mata Yaruna, all power to the people.
Shoot to kill! Guerrilla! Shoot to kill! Guerrilla!
The African National Congress of South Africa has welcomed the momentous campaign against apartheid, which is taking place in the United States.
We pay great tribute to the millions of people involved in the ever-expanding work within the worldwide anti-apartheid movement. They constitute a solid base of support for our struggle internationally. It is through their daily and sometimes unknown efforts that governments and peoples are kept alive to and mobilized in action against the numerous ploys of the South African racists to whitewash apartheid. We welcome the momentous campaign undertaken by the people of the United States and which is targeted on pressurizing the Reagan administration to reverse its support for the Pretoria racist regime.
This brings us to the end of today's edition of Dawn Breaks, the revolutionary voice of the African National Congress Women's Section, coming to you every Thursday evening at 9:30 South African time. We broadcast from the external service of Radio Zambia, Lusaka, on shortwave 31 meter bands, 9505 kilohertz. Until next week, Thursday, this is Tintswalo Mageza on behalf of the ANC Women's Section saying good night, the struggle continues, victory is certain.
The other thing that I think is impressive about the work by the Mater Group and the South African group is that when we think about political artwork, oftentimes people that are involved in social movements or political movements, we think about using artwork as sprucing up our demonstration, or we should have a big puppet down at the protest or something. But a lot of the stuff in the Science of Change show, and especially the stuff with Mater, was really asserting an identity and asserting a place at the table culturally, saying, you know, we are people. You know, it's like there's the photograph in here from the civil rights struggle from Memphis of a bunch of African-American men holding signs saying, I'm a man. It's not just that art is something you can do to beef up your good looks if you're protest or something, but it's intrinsically, I think, tied in with a lot of these struggles, and especially the struggles around land and, you know, even just human rights, of asserting that we are in place and we deserve to exist here.
Dara Greenwald and Josh McPhee, co-curators of Signs of Change.
This section is called Let It All Hang Out, and it is about politicized countercultures from the 60s till now, including we have Provo, we have the Diggers, we have the squatting movement, different squatting movements from all over. That's what all of these are, from different times and places.
Counterculture is important, has been important for our participation in it in our own lives. One of the things about countercultural movements is there's often a refusal to wait for some authority to actually get you what you want. Instead, you just take it for yourself. So the squatting movement is an extremely good example of that. There's people that need housing rather than go through the motions of trying to get people that you're in direct antagonism to give you the housing you want, you just take it. And then in the process of doing that, you actually liberate and open up spaces in the rest of your life, because when you're not spending 50, 60, 70% of your income on rent, all of that time and labor power can go towards other things that you care about.
Again, Alec Dunn.
There's also a section on squatting, which is mostly associated with European movements, at least the artifacts that we have culturally, although squatting exists around the world. Images from Christiana, which was an old military base in Denmark that was occupied in the 60s and is still squatted land. It's still free land. It's in Copenhagen. There's a few nice images here from Dea Trea Mork, who was a Danish artist. She was involved with a Danish collective called Red Mother, Rote Mor, which was a art and music collective. The music group had like top 10 hits in Denmark in the 60s. And the art wing produced graphic novels and posters and a lot of stuff for social movements in Denmark, a lot of Vietnamese solidarity stuff. So we have stuff down here from Dea Trea Mork, who was part of that. They're really nice. They're really evocative. And then we can see a collaborative piece by the Rote Mor group that is just about Christiana, where each artist would do a panel. But they did, it was a common thing that they would do these multi-panel pieces with different artists doing a panel each. Squatting, as we said, has been going on the history of mankind. But, you know, as far as the cultural artifacts here, I think that's what we have earliest in the show is stuff from Christiana.
The history of Christiania starts around 1971, where locals from the surrounding area knocked over the fence into what was a left military area that wasn't used by the military anymore. And in that time, there was a lack of housing, so loads of people moved into the area and they started to develop a community here.
I'm Helene Skov, and I'm the age of 45, and I live here in Christiania. This is called the Heaven's House, and I live here with my two daughters. I work in Green Hall, which our store for building materials, and that's why I could get a lot of building materials to make this house.
The most wonderful thing here is to take your bike and go around and see all these lovely houses and this lovely free nature. And then to cross the bridge, it's very special too. It's a very old bridge.
Cars is not allowed in Christiania. So that's why the bicycle shop is a very important place for us.
We can get up into 40 years later in Copenhagen as well, the struggle around, there was a youth center called Ungdomshuset, which was a squatted youth cultural center, punk venue, that was evicted a couple years ago, and it was had a pretty violent eviction, and then weekly riots for a few years, or weekly protests slash riots, or a ton of action, and it really mobilized a lot of youth in that city to fight for a space for themselves. And they actually, I think, were granted a space from the city. It was something of a compromise, but it was a big movement in Northern Europe for a while. And going along that wall, we can see stuff. There's some solidarity pieces with Ulrich Meinhof. There's a lot of this stuff crosses within the sections, even though this is laid in like the squatting section. There's anti-globalization stuff here. There's queer activist issues here. There is anti-globalization stuff from Japan, so it goes all over the place.
You are listening to Circle A Radio as we continue our audio tour through the Signs of Change art exhibit that's being displayed at the Pacific Northwest College of Art until March 19th. Again, this is Josh McPhee.
The next section is called Reclaim the Commons. This section encompasses a large number of focal points in society that we thought were important that aren't grouped together. It's often like the environmental movement is something over here, and then like struggle for housing is on the other side. And we thought it was important to put these things together because we see the right to housing and the right to have a planet that we can actually all still exist and live on as things that both come under this idea of the common, something that we share together. And that we need to struggle in order to maintain.
One of the earliest and most well-known things we find in this section is there's a couple images from People's Park, which was a squatted park in Berkeley in the 60s. I think it was land taken from UC Berkeley to make into a People's Park, and it's still in existence, but it was a really long struggle to establish that and keep that. So we start the section with that. There's a few images from a really long fight against the Narita Airport in Japan, which was an expansion of the Tokyo Airport. They're gorgeous images, and they also nicely represent that it was an interesting group because it involved a lot of farmers and peasants whose land was being taken away, as well as a kind of drew in people from the Japanese student movement, which was very militant, is still very militant, but starting in the late 60s, this was roughly a 20-plus-year struggle that involved a land occupation physically blocking the expansion of the airport with people living on it and fighting to keep that land. So to the right of that, we have four posters from the fight to save the International Hotel in San Francisco. And the International Hotel was a, I think, a single residency occupancy hotel, SRO hotel, that was mostly populated by Filipino Americans.
At the time when the International Hotel struggle happened, it was right on Kearney and Jackson that was like the last building, the last block of Manila Town that was still standing. San Francisco at the time was also going through a period where, you know, there was redevelopment. They were expanding into Western Addition, the Fillmore, as well as in Yerba Buena. So they were tearing down a lot of communities. But at the same time, it was a time when a lot of us as Asian Americans were becoming more aware of our heritage and the conditions of our communities. And that basically created sort of a backdrop for the I Hotel struggle.
The struggle began in 1968 when the first eviction notices were given to the elderly Minong residents. The International Hotel was spiritually healthy and was a hub for Filipino culture and community. But the I Hotel sat on valuable downtown property, the last remaining block of San Francisco's Manila Town.
You know, the owners wanted to tear the building down. They wanted to put up something more commercial like a parking lot.
In 1972, the building was put on the market, and it was purchased in 1973. The new owner was a foreign investor with no ties to the local community.
And the only way that we could stop eviction was being able to build our base of support, you know, in the community, outside the community. I mean, we really made those connections with the unions, with the churches, neighborhoods. We knew that having that strong base was our best offense against any further threats. You have to understand that at that time, there was a real mass movement that was building during those years after April 1976, that many people came and were in support of the tenants. There was one demonstration that happened in front of the hotel where thousands of people were marching around the whole block. And it was very, very significant because it really showed how much people were opposed to this eviction.
The decisive clash between the widespread community support and the property developers finally came on August 4th of 1977.
3,000 people out in front as a human barricade. There were several hundred police and sheriffs who basically seized the building, you know, from up on the roof and then through the front, clearing out the human barricade and just executing, going right inside the building. Real tragedy. People were tossed out on the street, you know. And, I mean, it was very degrading and humiliating for them to just be put out with all their belongings inside. And again, there was looting and, you know, ransacking of their property, their money. It was just really a sad time. It was really a traumatic experience for me, personally. I mean, I never thought it would resort to going that far. I mean, you never know what an eviction is until you actually live through it. I mean, I'll never forget the faces. I'll never forget those who suffered through it. You know, these were my friends. Actually, many of them were like my teachers because many of them were elderly men and women who were my closest friends.
The elderly residents, they could only find what they could find. A lot of it was they wanted to remain right there in Chinatown or in Manila Town. You know, the housing was really very dangerous for many of them because it wasn't home, wasn't like their family or friends around them protecting them. I think for a lot of them died of a broken heart. If you look at the I Hotel, it wasn't just a housing struggle, it was a fight to also open up other things like a bookstore, like Kearney Street Workshop, you know, the infancy of an Asian American art form. And then at the same time, this wasn't just something that pertained to San Francisco. It spread. It became a symbol for Asian Americans all over the country. It was on television for the whole country to see.
Alec Dunn.
There's a number of really interesting images and posters from the anti-nuclear movement worldwide. I really like a lot of the ones that came out of Northern Europe. They use a lot of Sunday cartoon kind of style. There's a fairly famous picture of a sun with its fist in the air and cartoon characters kicking missiles, which I believe were, Dutch. These are really great, and they're just... You still see a lot of these images on stickers all over Europe. So it's still a campaign that is being fought to keep nuclear missiles out of Europe and nuclear power. And one of the great things I think in this is a piece that is a document of a protest against a new nuclear naval base that was going to be built in Staten Island in New York City. And a group of artists and activists made stencils that listed exactly how far away you would be downwind of the nuclear naval base. So the piece we have in the show says 12.6 miles downwind of nuclear naval base. If you were in central Brooklyn or Manhattan, you'd probably be 4.2 miles. So these are spray painted on sidewalks. I think that that naval base was not built, but it was a lot because of real public pressure against it being built. And I think it's a great example of artists using agitational methods around a struggle. The Signs of Change show also has a lot of music and film and video. There's a nice piece, it's a pretty modern piece from 2008 from the Iraq Veterans Against War, and it was a documentation of a street action they did called Operation First Casualty, in which these veterans were patrolling and they were holding their arms up like they had rifles in them, but they didn't actually have rifles in them, so it was air rifling. But they're patrolling the streets and occasionally would pick someone out of the crowd as if they're on patrol in Iraq and saw them as a threat. It's a really powerful video, and if you can come down, I really recommend checking it out. It brings that idea of bring the war home. I mean, they're really showing what it's like for Iraqis to live in this occupied city, and also for the psychological mind that it is to be a soldier occupying a city. That's a great piece.
It is a national movement of veterans and service members. And every day there are more and more service members and veterans opposing this war and stepping forward and taking action against this war.
We're here today doing Operation First Casualty, which is a reference to the first casualty of war, which is the truth. One scenario is we take sniper fire, which happens all the time in Iraq. One soldier in the squad goes down, so we have to take care of him. But of course, in that situation, you cannot stay there. So we have to exit carrying the guy. These are everyday experiences in Iraq. I mean, absolutely. There's nothing abnormal about these things. And I think that the one thing that we probably don't do is we're not brutal enough. You know, you go into homes in the middle of the night and snatch people in the middle of villages, you know, and markets. And so that's the reality there, yeah, every day.
Well, I got back from the war in 2004. I'm from Chicago. We actually mobilized across the Midwest to come out here for this Operation Midwest Mobilization. So we deployed for the right reasons, you know, bring the truth of the war home. Let people know some humanity is needed.
Thank you,
for coming to the press conference for Operation First Casualty 2, New York City. We'll have statements, then there will be a short question and answer, followed by a demonstration.
The riot is a very common scenario also in Iraq, trying to detain the apparent leader of the riot while at the same time keeping the people back. And the point there is that there's a limited number of American soldiers trying to do this with a mass number of Iraqi civilians. And so it's very chaotic scenes. What has happened recently, I think, that has made IVAW so much more powerful is the local activists have really embraced IVAW. And so now it's like a team effort. And that's, I think, the change that has made this so successful, so that, because we could never do this on our own. You know, with the civilians, with the food, with the places to stay, with the fundraising. It's just really been an amazing experience.
And finally, let me just make this promise. There will be much more to come.
Count on! 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 7.
There is much more artwork in the Sons of Change exhibit at the Pacific Northwest College of Art, 1241 Northwest Johnson Street in Portland. Also, Dara and Josh have curated more video that is available for public viewing at the PNCA Library. Just ask the friendly librarians and they'll set you up with a stack of DVDs and a computer to watch them on. We'd like to thank Alec Dunn, Dara Greenwald, and Josh McPhee, as well as Mac McFarland from the Pacific Northwest College of Art for bringing the Signs of Change exhibit to Portland. And special thanks to Claude Marks from the Freedom Archives, who helped us with archive audio for this radio show. The full curator talk can be heard on the PNCA website, and we'll have a link to the specific page on our KBOO website, kboo.fm/CircleA Radio. Thank you for listening to Circle A Radio. We broadcast the first and third Wednesdays from 6 to 7 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland. To contact us, go to kboo.fm/CircleA Radio or write CircleA Radio@gmail.com. Our next show airs March 3rd. Thanks for listening.